Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
A teacher asks whether we should teach intelligent design in public schools. The answer may surprise you. That's our topic for today's edition of ID the Future. This is John West, Associate Director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. Recently, I was in Hollywood, California, for a post-play discussion after the final performance of the play, Disinherit the Wind. The play tells the story of a renowned neurobiologist with New Age sympathies who sues his university for the right to challenge neo-Darwinian evolution. His argument is that neo-Darwinian materialist thought has become a dogmatic orthodoxy that stifles free thought. After the play's performance, the audience got to discuss the play with its playwright and star, Matt Chait, biologist Jonathan Wells, and myself. One of the people in the audience was an educator who raised a really good question about whether intelligent design should be taught in science classes in public schools. I gave the first response, followed by Jonathan Wells, and then Matt Chait.
My familiarity with the term intelligent design came several years ago when there was the debate over what do we teach in school? Do we teach intelligent design or do we teach evolution? And I have also, I'm a product of the public school system. I'm now an educator in the public school system. And it is a very, very fragile machine. And, you know, essentially, if you're in a lot of cases, if you're going to get something across to a student, you have a very small window of time and space in which to do that. So the intelligent design theory is one, you know, that I have a lot of respect for, obviously, but as was addressed in the play, it's a theory and should be presented as such. So, in the case of public education, where explaining intelligent design is not the same thing as, you know, saying, this is five, I take away two, that's three, how, given the fragile nature of young people's minds and the education system itself, what is the ideal way to address the issue of life? And
thank you so much for raising that. Actually, Discovery Institute's position is you really shouldn't be presenting intelligent design, certainly shouldn't be requiring it in public schools. And that was why we objected and asked the Dover School District, which I think you might be referring to in 2006, where the big controversy, where we told them to please repeal their policy. They didn't listen to us. Our view is, in the public schools, you want to teach evolution, that's the majority theory, neo-Darwinism is, but you do want to teach it accurately and honestly. And so when there are arguments now among mainstream evolutionists, like last year, basically 200 prominent scientists from around the world converged at the Royal Society in London, one of the most prominent scientific societies in the world, because they were really debating what's after neo-Darwinism. And most of them were not intelligent design supporters in any way, shape, or form, but they recognized that blind random mutations conjoined with natural selection does not cut it to explain the major changes we see in the history of life. So I think what we ask is just something very minimal, which is teach the mainstream theory, but also teach the mainstream criticisms. Don't be using things like Haeckel's embryos that any good embryologist, no matter how Darwinian, would admit is not accurate and hasn't been accurate for a long time, but they persist in textbooks because, as Eugenie Scott from the National Center for Science Education, she's since retired, but her point was she wouldn't defend the accuracy of the diagrams, but they make a point that the underlying point is somehow valid, even if the graphics aren't. And so she sort of poo-pooed that it was a big deal. So I think our policy is much more minimal, which is teach what's in the textbooks, but teach what is already in the peer-reviewed literature of the criticisms of, I mean, for example, and Jonathan could go on more about this, we have great evidence now at the bacterial level. There's these great experiments that Richard Lenski, a committed Darwinian at Michigan State University, has done in real time over thousands of generations of bacteria. You can't model major evolutionary changes for most things because the generation time is too much, you know, and we only have a limited lifespan. But in bacteria, you have populations of, you know, millions and millions, and you can have 30, 40, 50, 60, 70,000 generations. We have good evidence of what random mutation can and can't do, and it's really minimal. Dr. Mamet, Jonathan, you could talk about the Lenski experiments. I mean, this would be an example of what I think would be worthwhile for students to learn about, the stuff that is kept out of most of the textbooks until maybe you're at a really, really senior level that people could know about.
On the Lenski experiment, which gets a lot of hype, basically what's happening is one species of bacterium is undergoing certain changes that are due to rearranging the genetic material under selection pressure. It doesn't explain how we get other species of bacteria. It doesn't explain how we get single-celled animals, multi-celled animals, plants, none of that. So it's really quite minimal, as John said.
Remember how the play started with a lecture. That lecture was 10 minutes long. And I could hear, and I heard on other nights, kind of audible reactions, kind of gasps, to how wondrous it is. Why isn't biology taught like that? I mean, why aren't children exposed to how wondrous the human body, any living body, is? Why? And it seems to me that maybe I'm being a little paranoid about it, but I think that the evolutionary establishment does not want us to get the impression of how absolutely complex, amazingly complex and precise and wondrous it is, because then there theory starts looking awfully frail and simplistic compared to this wondrous life of the cell.
You raise a great point. And I think a lot of biology teachers don't do it in a tedious way, so they do express some of the wonder, but that is something else. You don't have to bring in meta-level debates about whether the ultimate cause of this was unguided materialism or intelligent design. Just a good description of what's actually there. And I think of one of Jonathan's, my friend's, molecular biologist, Doug Axe, when he describes, when he was a student at Caltech, what got him actually thinking about there must be design here was, as an engineer, he was looking at some of those biochemical systems. Amazing engineering. And so teaching that well, then inquiring minds, people will want to ask the further questions.
If you want more information about Discovery Institute's recommendations for educational policy, go to our site at discovery.org/ID. That's discovery.org/ID. And then go to the Education tab. And if you're a teacher who has questions about what you should or shouldn't do in the classroom, please contact us so we can help. You can reach us by emailing cscinfo@discovery.org. That's cscinfo@discovery.org. Although Disinherit the Wind has now concluded its run in Hollywood, you can still purchase a script of the play by Matt Chait at Amazon.com. Just search for the title Disinherit the Wind. In future podcasts, we will share more of the fascinating discussion with the audience after the play, including the experiences of a biology professor who grew up in a communist country dominated by Darwin's theory. For ID the Future, this is John West.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.